The road was single width, two continuous ruts running north and south, jinking now and then to avoid a spring hare colony or a soft pan. It was patrolled regularly by the Botswana police on anti-poaching and prevention of alleged entry duties. Craig and Sally Ann reached the road in the middle of the afternoon. By this time, Craig had discarded the rifle and ammunition and stripped the pack of all but essentials. He had even considered for a while burying his manuscript for later retrieval. It weighed 8 pounds, but Sally Ann had dissuaded him in a hoarse whisper. The water bottle was empty. They had had their last drink, a blood-warm mouthful each just before noon. Their speed was reduced to little more than a mile an hour. Craig was no longer sweating. He could feel his tongue beginning to swell and his throat closing as the heat sucked the moisture out of him. They reached the road. Craig's gaze was fastened grimly on the heat-smudged horizon ahead, all his being concentrated on lifting one foot and placing it ahead of the other. They crossed the road without seeing it and kept going on into the desert. They were not the first to walk past the chance of succor and go on to death by thirst and exposure. They staggered onwards for 2 hours more before Craig stopped.
We should have reached the road by now, he whispered, and checked the compass heading again. The compass must be wrong. North isn't there.
He was confused and doubting.
Damage the bloody thing. We're too far south, he decided,
and began the first aimless circle of the lost and totally disorientated, the graveyard spiral that precedes death in the desert. An hour before sunset, Craig stumbled over a dried brown vine growing in the grey soil. It bore only a single green fruit the size of an orange. He knelt and plucked it as reverently as if it had been the Cullinan diamond. Mumbling to himself through cracked and bleeding lips, he split the fruit carefully with the bayonet. It was warm as living flesh from the sun.
Gemsbok melon, he explained to Sally Ann, as she sat and watched him with dull, uncomprehending eyes.
He used the point of the bayonet to mash the white flesh of the melon, and then held the half-shell to Sally Ann's mouth. Her throat pumped in the effort of swallowing the clear, warm juice, and she closed her eyes in ecstasy as it spread over her swollen tongue. Working with extreme care, Craig wrung a quarter of a cupful of liquid from the fruit and fed it to her. His own throat ached and contracted at the smell of the liquid as he made her drink. She seemed to recharge with strength before his eyes. And when the last drop had passed between her lips, she suddenly realized what he had done.
You, she whispered.
He took the hard rind and the squeezed-out pith and sucked on them.
Sorry.
She was distraught at her own thoughtlessness, but he shook his head.
Cool soon. Night.
He helped her up, and they stumbled onwards. Time telescoped in Craig's mind. He looked at the sunset and thought it was the dawn.
Wrong, wrong.
He took the compass and hurled it from him. It did not fly very far.
Wrong, wrong way.
He turned and led Sally Ann back. Craig's head filled with shadows and dark shapes. Some were faceless and terrifying, and he shouted soundlessly at them to drive them away. Some he recognized. Ash Levy rode past on the back of a huge shaggy hyena. He was brandishing Craig's new manuscript, and his gold-rimmed spectacles glinted blindly in the sunset.
"Can't make a paperback sale," he gloated. "Nobody wants it, baby. You're finished. One book man, Craig, baby. That's you."
Then Craig realized that it was not his manuscript, but the wine list from the Four Seasons.
"Shall we try Corton Charlemagne?" Ash taunted Craig. "Or a magnum of the widow?"
"Only witch doctors ride hyena,"
Craig yelled back, no sound issuing from his desiccated throat.
"Always knew you were..."
Ash hooted with malicious laughter, spurred the hyena into a gallop, and threw the manuscript in the air. The white pages fluttered to the earth like roosting egrets, and when Craig went down on his knees to gather them, they turned to handfuls of dust, and Craig found he could not rise. Sally Ann was down beside him, and as they clung to each other, the night came down upon them. When he woke, it was morning, and he could not rouse Sally Ann. Her breathing snored and soared through her nose and open mouth. On his knees, he dug the hole for a solar still. Though the soil was soft and friable, it went slowly. Laboriously still on his knees, he gathered an armful of the scattered desert vegetation. It seemed there was no moisture in the woody growth, where he chopped it finely with the bayonet and laid it in the bottom of his hole. He cut the top off the empty aluminium water bottle and placed the cup, this formed, in the centre of the hole. It required enormous concentration to perform even these simple tasks. He spread the plastic ground sheet over the hole and anchored the edges with heaped earth. In the centre of the sheet, he gently laid a single round of ammunition, so that it was directly above the aluminium cup. Then he crawled back to Sally Ann and sat over her so that his shadow kept the sun off her face.
It's going to be all right, he told her. We'll find the road soon. We must be close.
He did not realize that no sound came from his throat, and that she would not have been able to hear him even if it had.
That little turd Ash is a liar. I'll finish the book. You'll see. I'll pay off what I owe. We'll get a movie deal. I'll buy King's Lynn. It'll be all right. Don't worry, my darling.
He waited out the baking heat of the morning, containing his impatience, and at noon, by his wristwatch, he opened the still. The sun, beating down on the plastic sheet, had raised the temperature in the covered hole close to the boiling point. Evaporation from the chopped plants had condensed on the underside of the plastic sheet and run down it towards the sag of the bullet. From there, it dripped into the aluminium cup. He had collected half a pint. He took it between both hands, shaking so violently that he almost spilled it. He took a small sip and held it to his mouth. It was hot, but it tasted like honey, and he had to use all his self-control to prevent himself swallowing. He leaned forward and placed his mouth over Sally Ann's blackened and bleeding lips. Gently he injected the liquid between them.
Drink, my sweet. Drink it up.
He found he was giggling stupidly as he watched her swallow painfully. A few drops at a time, he passed the precious fluid from his own mouth into hers, and she swallowed each sip more easily. He kept the last mouthful for himself and let it trickle down his throat. It went to his head like strong drink, and he sat grinning stupidly through fat, scaly black lips, his face swollen and sun-baked purple-red, the abrasions on his cheek covered with a crusty weeping scab, and his bloodshot eyes gummed up with dried mucus. He rebuilt the still and lay down beside Sally Ann. He covered her face from the sun with the tail torn from his shirt and whispered,
"All right, fine, find help soon. Don't worry, my love."
But he knew that that was their last day. He could not keep her alive for another. Tomorrow, they would die. At sunset, the still gave them another half cup of distilled water, and after they had drunk it, they fell into a heavy, death-like sleep in each other's arms. Something woke Craig, and for a moment he thought it was the night wind in the scrub. With difficulty, he pushed himself into a sitting position and cocked his head to listen, not sure whether he was still hallucinating or whether he was truly hearing that soft rise and fall of sound. It must be nearly dawn, he realized. The horizon was a crisp dark line beneath the velvet drape of the sky. Then, abruptly, the sound firmed, and he recognized it, the distinctive beat of a four-cylinder Land Rover engine. The 3rd Brigade had not abandoned the hunt. They were coming on relentlessly, like hyenas with the reek of blood in their nostrils. He saw a pair of headlights far out across the desert, their pale beams swinging and tilting as the vehicle covered the rough ground. He groped for the AK-47. He could not find it. Ash Levy must have stolen it, he thought bitterly, taking it off with him on the hyena. I never did trust the son of a bitch. Craig stared hopelessly at the approaching headlights. In their beams danced a little pixie-like figure, a diminutive yellow mannequin.
Puck, he thought. Fairies. I never believed in fairies. Don't say that. When you do, one dies. Don't want to kill fairies. I believe in them.
His mind was going. Fantasy mixed with flashes of lucidity. Suddenly he recognized that the little half-naked yellow mannequin was a bushman, one of the pygmy desert race. A bushman tracker. The 3rd Brigade were using a bushman tracker to hunt them down. Only a bushman could have run on their spoor all night, tracking by the headlights of the Land Rover. The headlights flashed over them like a stage spotlight, and Craig lifted his hand to shade his eyes. The light was so bright that it hurt. He had the bayonet in his other hand behind his back.
I'll get one of them, he told himself. I'll take one of them.
The Land Rover stopped only a few paces away. The little bushman tracker was standing near them, clicking and clucking in his strange bird-like language. Craig heard the door of the Land Rover open behind the blinding lights, and a man came towards them. Craig recognized him instantly. General Peter Fungerbearer. He seemed as tall as a giant in the back lighting of the headlights as he strode towards where Craig huddled on the desert floor.
Thank you, God, Craig prayed. Thank you for sending him to me before I died.
And he gripped the bayonet.
In the throat, he told himself, as he stoops over me.
He marshalled all his remaining strength, and General Peter Fungerbearer stooped towards him.
Now, Craig made the effort, drive the point into his throat.
But nothing happened. His limbs would not respond. He was finished. There was nothing left.
I have to inform you that you are under arrest for illegal entry into the Republic of Botswana, sir, said General Fungerbearer.
But he had changed his voice. He was using a deep, gentle, caring voice in heavily accented English.
He won't fool me, Craig thought, the tricky bastard.
And he saw that Peter Fungerbearer was wearing the uniform of a sergeant of Botswana police.
You are lucky, he went down on one knee. We found where you were crossing the road.
He was holding a felt-covered water bottle to Craig's mouth.
We have been following you since 3 o'clock yesterday.
Cool, sweet water gushed into Craig's mouth and ran down his chin. He let the bayonet drop and grabbed for the bottle with both hands. He wanted to gulp it all down at once. He wanted to drown in it. It was so marvellous that his eyes flooded with tears. Through the tears, he saw the Botswana police crest on the open door of the Land Rover.
Who?
He stared at Peter Fungerbearer. But he had never seen this face before. It was a broad, flat-nosed face, puckered now with worry and concern, like that of a friendly bulldog.
Who?
He croaked.
Please do not talk. We must get you and the lady to hospital at Francistown pretty bloody quickly. Plenty people die in the desert. You goddamn lucky.
You aren't General Fungerbearer, he whispered. Who are you?
Botswana Police, Border Patrol. Sergeant Simon Mafakeng, at your honour's service, sir.
As a boy, before the Great Patriotic War, Colonel Nikolai Bukharin had accompanied his father on the wolf hunts, hunting the packs that terrorized their remote village in the high Urals during the long, harsh winter months. Those expeditions into the vast, gloomy tiger forests had nurtured in him a deep passion for the hunt. He enjoyed the solitude of wild places and the primeval joy of pitting all his senses against a dangerous animal. Eyesight, hearing, smell, and the other extraordinary sense of the born hunter that enabled him to anticipate the twists and evasions of his quarry. All these the colonel still possessed in full strength, despite his 62 years, together with a memory for facts and faces that was almost computer-like, they had enabled him to excel at his work, had seen him elevated to the head of his department of the 7th Commissariat, where he had hunted professionally the most dangerous game of all, man. when he hunted boar and bear on the great estates reserved for the recreations of high officers of the GRU and KGB, he had alarmed his comrades and the gamekeepers by scorning to fire from the prepared hides and by going on foot alone into the thickest cover. The thrill of great physical danger had satisfied some deep need in him. When the assignment on which he was now engaged had been channeled through to his office, on the second floor of the central headquarters on Dzerzhinsky Square, he had recognized its importance immediately and taken control of it personally. With careful cultivation, that first potential was gradually being realized. And when the time had come for Colonel Bukharin at last to meet his subject face to face on the ground over which they would maneuver, he had chosen the cover which best suited his tastes. Russians, especially Russians of high rank, were objects of hostile suspicion in the new Republic of Zimbabwe. During the Chemurenga, the War of Independence, Russia had chosen the wrong horse and given her support to Joshua Nkomo's ZIPRA, the Matabele revolutionary wing. As far as the government in Harare was concerned, the Russians were the new colonialist enemy, while it was China and North Korea who were the true friends of the revolution. For these reasons, Colonel Nikolai Bukharin had entered Zimbabwe on a Finnish passport bearing a false name. He spoke Finnish fluently, as he did five other languages, including English. He needed a cover under which he could freely leave the city of Harare, where his every move would be watched over, and go out into the unpopulated wilderness where he could meet his subject without fear of surveillance. Although many of the other African republics, under pressure from the World Bank and the International Monetary Fund, had banned big game hunting, Zimbabwe still licensed professional hunters to operate their elaborate safaris in the designated controlled hunting areas. These were large earners of foreign exchange for the embattled economy. It amused the colonel to pose as a prosperous timber merchant from Helsinki, and to indulge his own love of the hunt in this decadent manner reserved almost exclusively for the financial aristocrats of the capitalist system. Of course, the budget that had been allocated for this operation could not stand such extravagance. However, General Peter Funkelbearer, the subject of the operation, was a wealthy and ambitious man. He had made no difficulties when Colonel Bukharin had suggested that they use a big game hunting safari as a cover for their meeting, and that General Funkelbearer should be allowed the honour of acting as host and of paying the $1,000 per diem that the safari cost. Standing in the centre of the small clearing now, Colonel Bukharin looked at his man. The Russian had deliberately wounded the bull. Nikolai Bukharin was a fine shot with pistol, rifle and shotgun, and the range had been 30 yards. If he had chosen, he could have placed a bullet in either of the bull's eyes, in the very centre of the bright black pupil. Instead, he had shot the animal through the belly, a hand's width behind the lungs, so as not to impair its wind, but not far enough back to damage the hindquarters, and so slow it down in the charge. It was a marvellous bull, with a mountainous boss of black horn that would fetch 50 inches or more around the curve from point to point. A 50-inch bull was a trophy few could match. And as he had drawn first blood, it would belong to the colonel, no matter who delivered the coup de grace. He was smiling at Peter Funkelbearer as he poured vodka into the silver cup of his hip flask. "Na zdorovye," he saluted Peter, and tossed it down without blinking, refilled the silver cup, and offered it to him. Peter was dressed in starched and crisply ironed fatigues, with his name tag on the breast, and a khaki silk scarf at his throat, but he was bareheaded with no insignia to sparkle in the sunlight and alarm the game. He accepted the silver cup and looked over the rim at the Russian. He was as tall as Peter, but even slimmer, erect as a man 30 years younger. His eyes were a peculiar pale, cruel blue. His face was riven with the scars of war and of other ancient conflicts, so that it was a miniature lunar landscape. His skull was shaven. The fine stubble of hair that covered it was silver and sparkled in the sunlight like glass fibres. Peter Funkelbearer enjoyed this man. He enjoyed the aura of power that he wore like an emperor's cloak. He enjoyed the innate cruelty in him that was almost African, and which Peter understood perfectly. He enjoyed his deviousness, the layering of lies and truths and half-truths, so that they became indistinguishable. He was excited by the sense of danger that exuded from him so powerfully that it had almost an odour of its own. "We are the same breed," Peter thought, as he lifted the silver cup and returned the salute. He drank down the pungent spirit at one swallow. Then, breathing carefully so as not to show the smallest sign of distress, he handed back the cup.
"You drink like a man," Nikolai Bukharin admitted. "Let us see if you hunt like one."
Peter had guessed correctly. It had been a test. The vodka and the buffalo bull, both of them. He shrugged to show his indifference, and the Russian beckoned to the professional hunter, who stood respectfully out of earshot. The hunter was a Zimbabwe-born white man in his late 30s, dressed for the part in wide-brimmed hat and khaki gillet, with heavy-caliber cartridges in the loops across his breast. He had a thick, curly, dark beard and an extremely unhappy expression on his face, as befits a man who is about to follow a gut-shot buffalo bull into dense riverine bush.
"General Fungabera will take the .458, Colonel Bukharin said, and the hunter nodded miserably. How had the strange old bastard managed to make a muck-up of a sitting shot like that? He had been shooting like a busily champion up to now. Christ, but that bush looked really nasty.
The hunter suppressed a shiver and snapped his fingers for the number two gun-bearer to bring up the heavy rifle.
"You will wait here with the bearers," said the Russian quietly.
"Sir," the hunter protested quickly, "I can't let you go in alone. I'd lose my license. It's just not on."
"Enough," said Colonel Bukharin.
"But, sir, you don't understand."
"I said enough."
The Russian never raised his voice, but those pale eyes silenced the younger man completely. He found suddenly that he was more afraid of this man than of losing his license, or of the wounded bull in the bush ahead. He subsided and stepped back thankfully. The Russian took the .458 from the gun-bearer, shot the bolt back to check that it was loaded with soft-tipped bullets, and then handed it to Peter Fungabera. Peter took it from him, smiling slightly, hefted it, then handed it back to the gun-bearer. Colonel Bukharin raised one silver eyebrow and smiled also. The smile was mockery, shaded with contempt. Peter spoke sharply in Shona to the bearer.
"Eh, mumble."
The man ran and snatched another weapon from one of the other black bearers. He brought it back to Peter, clapping softly to show his respect. Peter weighed this new weapon in his hands. It was a short-shafted, stabbing assegai. The handle was of hardwood bound with copper wire. The blade was almost 2 feet long and 4 inches broad. Carefully, Peter shaved the hairs off the back of his thumb with the edge of the silver blade. Then, deliberately, he shrugged off his jacket and stripped his trousers and jungle boots. Dressed only in a pair of olive-green shorts and carrying the stabbing assegai, he said,
"This is the African way, Colonel."
The Russian was no longer smiling.
"But I do not expect a man of your years to hunt the same way."
Peter excused him courteously.
"You may use your rifle again."
The Russian nodded, conceding the exchange. He had lost that one. But now let's see if this black mujik can make good his boast. Bukharin looked down at the spoor. The great hoof prints were the size of soup plates, and the thin watery gouts of blood were tinged with greenish-yellow dung from the ruptured bowels.
"I will track," he said. "You will watch for the break."
They moved off easily, with the Russian 5 paces ahead, stooping attentively to the blood spoor, and Peter Fungabera drifting behind him, the assegai held underhand, and his dark eyes covering the bush ahead with a steady rhythmic sweep, trained eyes not expecting to see the whole animal, searching for the little things, perhaps the shine of a wet nuzzle, or the drooping curve of a great horn. Within 20 paces the bush closed in around them. It was sultry green as a hothouse, dank vegetation pressing breathlessly around them. The air stank of the rotting leaf mould that deadened their footfalls. The silence was oppressive, so that the drag of a thorny branch across the Russian's leather leggings sounded loud as a truck engine. He was sweating. Perspiration soaked his shirt in a dark patch between the shoulder blades and sparkled like dewdrops on the back of his neck. Peter could hear his breathing, deep and harsh, but knew instinctively that it was not fear that worked in the Russian, but the pervading excitement of the hunter. Peter Fungerbearer did not share it. There was a coldness in him where his own fear should have been. He had trained himself to that during the Chemurenga. This was a necessary task, this thing with the assegai. It was to impress the Russian only, and with all fear and feeling anaesthetized by the coldness, Peter Fungerbearer prepared himself. He felt his muscles charging, felt the tension build in his sinews and nerves until he was like an arrow notched against the curve of the longbow. With his eyes, he swept the bush directly in the run of the spoor, only lightly, and concentrated his main attention on the flanks. This beast that they were hunting was the most cunning of all the dangerous game of Africa, except perhaps the leopard. But it was possessed of the brute strength of 100 leopards. The lion will growl before he charges. The elephant will turn under the punishment of heavy bullets in the chest. But the Cape buffalo comes in silence, and only one thing will stop his charge, and that is death.